So our new space, beautiful, beautifully decorated, air-conditioned. Buddha to my right, flowers to my left and right. Lighting exquisite. Right? So what's stopping us, you see? We still have to engage with the Dharma, no matter how perfect the setting, no matter how welcoming the room, no matter how elegant or eloquent our communication and talk, it still requires us to meet it, still requires us to engage it. And so all of this is meant to do just that. It's meant to further encourage us towards that end. And I hope people don't get lost in the comforts and the ease of the facility and not forget the reason why we meet in community is much more direct and powerful than the comforts that we settle into. So I want to speak tonight about inclining our mind toward love. But I want to bring in the sense of belonging that I mentioned very briefly last week in the Dharma Center's opening, because it's a theme I think that's missed in many situations and occasions. And it seems right that as we open a new center, that part of the reason we're drawn towards a physical location is that need that we each have to belong somewhere, to call a place our home, to be able to rest and to reside in a physical location. And but we should also realize that unless we find a deeper sense of belonging in ourselves than a physical room to settle in, that we will be missing something tremendously important to our Dharma life, Dharma perspective. In fact, it is through belonging that we can rest in love. And unless we belong, there is no room for love. We crowd it out with our searching, with our desperation, with our neediness. And so this sense of belonging is really essential to the theme that we've been speaking about since January, this theme of birthing the heart. Now, let me just explain a little bit why belonging is so important. Because belonging is being at rest, isn't it? When you truly belong, when you truly feel at home, even in the luxuries of our own private dwelling, you have a kind of ease. You put your feet up on the coffee table, if that's your manner. But there's a kind of ease. You sort of take your billfold out and put it on the coffee table or whatever it is, the side table. And there's a repose, a relaxation that probably no other situation brings forth in us like that. And it's an indication of that degree of relaxation, that degree of releasing the tension of the day of our lives that home represents to us. And so too does belonging, the sense of belonging, carry that at easement. But the sense of belonging has to be universally applied, not just in one location. When I was a hospice worker, I'm going to be telling several stories tonight. I feel like a story night. But when I was in hospice work, I wanted to understand death and dying very urgently. And so I was very tuned to the patient who was dying or the family of the patient who was grieving. And I found that my heart just poured forth. But then at the end of the day, I would go home and I would be as crabby as I was not really having been affected or carried over the theme of the connectedness of death and dying, or the heart opening that I had with the patients. And I realized that in order for this to work, I had to step through the threshold of my life and bring this same kind of attention forth. And in the theme of belonging, that's what's needed. We have to step through our own threshold, the way that we belong to our home and the relaxation that we have within it. We have to step out of that particular container into the whole range of our life in order to truly belong. And in order for that to happen, there's just a few pointers, I think, that can encourage us in that direction. And the first pointer is that we are always in the right place at the right time, even if we're late. Okay? So there has to be a way. Of course, we try to get on time, we try to be prompt. But there's a way that we have to be so settled in ourselves that we don't bring the anxiety of our being out of location or in the wrong time frame. Oh, I should have been earlier, or whatever it is that we carry with ourselves that keep us just off center from that sense of belonging that is the essential element to owning our life. And so the sense of always being in the right place at the right time. Right? That you don't need to apologize. I remember I was a monk in Thailand, and there was once every month they would have this banquet where all the Thais that lived in the villages would come and bring food for the monks, and the monks were there to receive the food and would offer blessings, and we would have a long eating ceremony and some Dharma discussions and talks, and then everybody would go home. And it was important for the monks to be there on time. And there was another Westerner that was living in the monastery at that point. And right about 10 or 15 minutes before we were supposed to go down to this ceremony, I heard him yelling out. So I went over to his hut, and he told me that a poisonous snake, or what appeared to be a poisonous snake, had fallen in his roof, in his little hut, and had crawled under the beams. And I had to help him get it out. So we were banging on the roof and trying to disturb the snake so that it would move on. And after a great deal of time, probably 20, 25 minutes, the snake finally left the little hut. And then he and I started walking down to the ceremony, which we both knew we were late for. And on the way I was saying, oh my God, this is the most embarrassing thing. Two Westerners coming into we're not supposed to be late. And so I was just grumbling like that on the way down. And he turned to me and he said, Rodney, well, my name wasn't Rodney then, I won't, but he said, my monk's name, and then he said, you have nothing to apologize for. You helped me in a time when I desperately needed someone to help me. And we walk in there. I suggest that we walk in there straight, holding that dignity of what we have just done together. And it was just a strong lesson of maintaining one's rightness of place and time despite circumstances. It's not what... We usually kind of cringe at that, and we're full of excuses and apologies. And perhaps if we're unethical, there's a growing sense of the theme of sneakiness that we live with. But when we live with an ethical integrity, you walk in and you have nothing to apologize for. If somebody asks why you're late, you explain to them. But it's not like you cringe at the thought of having to explain yourself. And there's a sense of belonging that lives within the ethics of our lives. And that sense of relaxation that coincides with that sense of belonging. The second way we belong to ourselves is that we think of all time as being my time. Usually we fracture our lives. This is time for work, this is time for relationship, this is time to reading, alone time. And we have compartments throughout the day, and we move from one way of expressing ourselves into the next compartment of time. But to really belong, all of those compartments need to be held within the whole of it all being my time. Now is my time for reading. Now is my time to relate with family. Now is my... So there's no disturbance in across those boundaries. The disturbance is when you hold to that compartment and it's violated, and therefore it's no longer your time. It's an intrusion on your time. Instead of opening it up and say, oh, this is the time for whatever it is to happen. For instance, I had a student who had a young daughter who's very interested in meditation, about 4 years old, maybe three or four. And her mom would be sitting, and she would come in, and at first her mother had organized the child's time so that she would have other occupying things to do while she was trying to sit. But inevitably her daughter would come in, and finally she let her daughter come in and just sit down wherever she wanted to and sit with her for however long she wanted to sit together as mother and daughter. And then whenever that ended, she would then invite the daughter to do the next thing together. And so her time for meditation became her time with her daughter, in which part of that, maybe just a few minutes, was actually meditating as such. So every moment is as important as every other moment. And this is the third direction of our belonging. The third way that we meet life without resistance, as a settled, relaxed response within it. And it is from that settledness that we can know love. If we are unsettled with any of these attributes of belonging, we'll find ourselves at odds with our living situation and unable to love. So this third one is, each moment is as important as every other. Now that's really all of these things push us very far and very deep. And they all make sense. I mean, every moment is precious as every other. Of course, I mean, there's a Dharma logic to it, and everybody goes, yes, of course, until you are in a very disturbing situation on I-5, and you're not getting to wherever it is your appointment needs at the right time. And then see whether every moment is as important as every other. Or the time that you're waiting for something to occur and the time that it does occur, those two moments, that differential, are those equal? Or the time you really want to be quiet and suddenly you're interrupted. You see? Where is the... Just to meet it, to belong within that moment, to truly relax within that circumstance. That is the art, that's the precious art of the Dharma. That's why we're meeting here. And finally, that each place I am in is my exact location. So that wherever we find ourselves to be, even if it's in a state of confusion, our body guides us to the principle of where we are. And it is there that we own our place and we belong. So each of these together, when practiced, repeatedly practiced, take one and just start moving it through the course of your day. Watch how disturbed we become when we have to explain ourselves, or we're being questioned, or we're late, or we find ourselves waiting for something to occur that has yet to occur. And we keep giving away our precious life on earth for the benefit of what will happen, not for the actualization of what is happening. Just get a sense of how we lean into life in a kind of constant motion that keeps us from settling in and belonging. Because belonging is the art of connecting. We can't connect out of body. We have to connect through body, through location, through time. And it is then through the connection that we can, our heart can actually share in the meeting of what transpires. And so belonging brings us into connectedness. And connectedness is the circumstance in which the heart can open and truly validate the moment that is there. Many decades ago, when they had iron lungs, an iron lung, for those who are younger, were breathing mechanisms, usually for people who had polio, survived the polio, but had a respiratory difficulty and just breathing by themselves. They were placed in these big ovals with their heads sticking out in a big tube that allowed them to be, their lungs to be manually operated through different pressures within that tube. So anyway, a doctor I met many decades ago was walking through, I think he's was at the VA hospital, and there was a whole corridor of iron lungs. And one young man, youngish man, was there, and the doctor stopped and looked at his chart and saw that he had been in an iron lung for 10 years. And he said, just because it just sort of floored him that someone could live in that state for that length of time. He said, what keeps you going? And the man said, he looked up and he said, you see these window vents at the top of this corridor? He says, every once in a while, one of the attendants will leave the window cracked open. And as I lie here, a breeze will come in through that cracked vent and touch my cheek. And he said, that's what keeps me going. I bring that story up because unless he had felt that sense of belonging, even within the circumstances, the very difficult circumstances of being in the environment of an iron lung, unless he had settled sufficiently within his own belonging, he would have missed that breeze. And so he would have missed his heart's sharing of the preciousness of that moment. So you can get a sense that it's all around us at all times. And we are far luckier than many people who are compromised in our physical or mental ability. And it's often because we are so healthy and at the top of our game that we forget what life is about. We forget that the sense of belonging, the sense of meeting life in its exactly where it is and where we are, is the opening of the door of the heart and the beginning of the accessing to love. Many of us try to find access to love through our busyness, through trying to decide what we need to do in order to find love, when what we really need to do is to stop and let love find us. Because it's in our stopping that we find the belonging necessary for that meeting to transpire. Joseph Campbell wrote this: all compassion, all caring, all love is irrational. That's the point. The rational is stressing the I-thou opposites. The mind is in the world of separateness and singular structures, angular. Love puts the world together in a way that can't be calculated. Compassion, love, those jump mathematics. You see, for whatever reason, we find ourselves within a culture at a time of our species in which the rational is our investment. Universities are our cathedrals. And the angular structures, the operation of the way the mind works, is our conceded power. The problem with that is that you can't find connection within it. It's always looking out in trying to improve the product that is there. So, a story about two nurses I knew quite well. One was a woman who was very efficient nurse. She gave her pills on time. She did all of her charting. She was always prompt, well-dressed, orderly, and precise in everything she did. The second nurse was a little bit different. She would be a little late in her note-taking. She would give the pill a little off in terms of schedule. But she would spend enormous amount of time with the patients by their bedside. And everybody adored her. The staff, the patients, everybody. Because she was so warm-hearted. And she said to me one time, she said, I wish, her name was Evelyn, Nancy was the more meticulous one, she said, I wish I was more like Nancy. I wish I could get myself to be more productively efficient. And I said, well, I'll tell you, Evelyn, if I'm in the hospital, you're the nurse I want. You're the one I want, but I don't care if I get my pill 15 minutes late. You may get yelled at by the physicians, but you won't get yelled at by me. Because to have you here is a comfort to me. Something that I may not find from somebody who is too efficient and only has a certain amount of time to offer me. This sense of measurement, of productivity, of love being, or effectiveness being measurable, so that you'll see in hospitals, when there is a budget cut, those that are removed or that have, whose hours are cut back, are not the nursing corps or the physicians, because they're needed to produce the effective result. It's the social workers, it's the chaplains, it's the people who can stand by your bedside and guide you through your illness with a different sense of priority that is not measurable, that is not productively related. It won't help you get your pill on time, but it may well help you heal quicker, although that's kind of subjective experience. It's interesting when we get pushed to the point of making a decision as to what we release and what we maintain. It shows a lot about the nature of what we really believe to be true. And to be pushed to that extent and to give up the contact of the heart, I think is a real mistake that we make. So most of us meet the moment, each moment, with a sense of connection, because that's the theme of Dharma. So we're learning how to connect. But we don't move with the heart within that connection. We often move with the intellect within that connection. And just a story around the difference between those two, one that I have told, and some of you know, I'm sure, is that I have a meditation friend and teacher who was with his dying mother. And as a teacher, he was trying to show his mother how to die well, as if he had already experienced it. And so he was with his mother, who was in her last moments, and he could feel a tension in her grip. He was holding her hand. And he realized that he needed to give her a Dharma talk. So he gives her a few minute talk about the need to let go of life and that it's passing and that there's no reason to hold on and all of that. Meanwhile, her grip on his hand was getting tighter. So he realized it wasn't working. See, that's the mind's response, right? Okay, I'll be clever with my mother and try to talk her into an easy death. Which, of course, didn't work. But then his heart just opened to the fact that his mother was going through this difficulty. And he says to her, "Mother, I love you." And her, at that moment, her grip lessened, and she was able to die. So when he gave himself over, not to the mechanical intellect's response to what is needed, but to his heart's response to what is needed, he was inclining his life towards love. And the effect was immediately obvious. So love is often missed because it's not productive. It's not seen as something measurable. In fact, it's often ego, it's in service of our egos. It's like, we are willing to allow our heart to open as long as I look better after it's open than I did before. I'm more appreciated. People like me better. And that's the reason I'll work on it that way then. I'll work on it because it allows me to be a better person so that other people can appreciate me. All that is an ego fabrication. It's working on the nature of ourselves for the end product that we will be. And when we do that, the product does get better. It's just that we're not doing it for love's sake, we're doing it for the product's sake. And so instead of actually focusing on love, we're focusing on the improvement that love will give us. And that throws the whole thing in a different direction. It throws us all off balance. Because we're not caring about the very measure of what we are producing or what we are meeting. Love for its own sake. And along those same lines, you can see that when we infuse love within an object, me, I'm getting better, when I look better, when I'm, my heart is open, or we infuse love into someone I love, the object of my love, or the possession of my love, the thing, the circumstance, the environment I love, and objects change, then we can be assured that we will grieve. Because we will grieve the loss of love because the object that we invested it in is no longer around or is in altered shape. So when we invest our love into objects and possessions, into quantifiable results, and the inevitability of those objects is that they will and are going to change, then we can be assured that love will let us down and that we will hurt because we loved. So in order for us to be self-protected, we get very mistrusting of the feeling of love. It's let us down before. Unrequited. Or unresponded. Or it died. Or it changed. Or it left. And instead of seeing it as the misrepresentation of love, we take it as the fact of what love did to us. And so if we can, we see that all objects, which is one of the encouragements of Buddhism, is to begin to live with the fact that all objects are in transition, are not dependable, are unreliable, but that love is reliable, is trustworthy. But if you invest that love in a particular circumstance, then you will think that love is untrustworthy because the circumstance will change. So many of us, when we approach love, we approach it from the pain of our memory. We don't trust it. It's let us down in the past. I had a boyfriend once that, or a girlfriend, or a situation. And we close ourselves off because of that pain. We remember that pain. And we're very reluctant to trust again. And that's why I'm bringing in this sense of belonging. It's a different perspective to love. I mean, we can all hear this and say, okay, I'll try to love again. But it's very deep. The pain is very deep in most of us around this subject. Many of us have a deep accumulation of grief, repository of grief within us that meets every time we develop a certain sensitivity or a particular connectedness or intimacy, this overwhelming grief arises. And we shy away from a deeper connection because of the pain of the past. Or we get so self-focused on our life. All the arrows come into the problems I'm having, and within that self-focus, it's very hard to connect at all to anything other than our own lives and what the troubles we're going through. And that also blocks a sense of belonging, because the troubles are telling us that we should belong somewhere else, out of trouble. And that again blocks the entrance of the heart, the connectedness of the heart. In a story of a young 9-year-old girl who I worked with in hospice care, she had cystic fibrosis, and she was, when I was there with her, she strained her, would hold her neck straight like that so that she could have enough room in order just to breathe in the bare amount of air she could to survive. I just remember it like that. And she was just a dear, dear young girl. And her family situation was at that time kind of turbulent because her mother was divorcing her father, not at the father's suggestion, but because the mother had gotten involved with somebody else. And this young girl knew that. And so we were all there together, the mother, the father. She was in bed, straining like this. And she asked us all to leave the room. Well, sometimes when that occurs, I sense that the patient wants to die alone, is asking us to leave the room so that she could just have that space to be able to die. So we all left the room, and I prepared the family that she may not be alive when we go back in. Well, what she actually did during that time was to get up somehow out of bed and to make a big I love you poster for her father. And she had that, and she hid it under the blankets, and then called us back in. We came back in, and she was still alive, obviously. And then she took this poster that she had made for her father, and because she knew that he was in so much pain over the divorce, the impending divorce, and her daughter's death, or dying, she offered that to him. And then died just a few days later. And I remember speaking with the father after the child's death, and the father telling me that the first thing he did when he got home was to frame that I love you poster, put it in a central place in his life. But she was able to look beyond the immediate situation, beyond that self-referencing that many of us are lost within for much of our life. And you could see that even though she was 9 years old, how she had the wisdom to even reflect upon the pain of another, given what she was going through, somehow she did. And she was able to make a connection, lasting and meaningful connection, that probably few of us would have been able to do. Sometimes wisdom exceeds age. There are so many examples of people who are on the edge of their life asking the caregiver how they're doing, wanting to comfort the caregiver for what they're going through. I'm often feel like I'm on holy ground when I see that occurring. Because you sense that this person somehow is able to move out of their self-referencing, to establish contact, that in the midst of our healthy lives, few of us are able to make. You see how important belonging is when you see that in occurring. Because if you're worried about your particular situation or where you are or whether the right timing is there, it throws the whole thing into just out of kilter. There's no connection. There's just ponderance. It's just the busyness of thought. And unless until we can settle, knowing exactly where we are, with clear eyes. That connection can't be made. And so, love, we start with love. By, in this tradition, first owning our body and settling into the place where our body rests. And it's through the body that we touch the earth, and it's through the earth that we have a sense of collectedness and connection. In fact, I was teaching at Spirit Rock some years ago, and one woman knew that I was a hospice worker at that time, and she told me of her son's death. And she said the reason that she came to retreats was that for those brief days that she lived on retreat, she felt so connected to the earth, and she knew that when she was connected to the earth, that she was connected to her dead son. And that's as close as she could ever be to him, was through her sense of connection to the earth. Without that busyness, without the, oh, I should be somewhere else, without the turbulence of how much longer, when will this ever be over? How can I, where should I be, what is going on? It's not getting easier out there, at least not from my perspective. War is breaking out. Some of the most turbulent and potentially threatening situations in my lifetime happening simultaneously. That the only thing I have to offer it is my belonging, is my seat. And I sense that being able to sit on the earth, with the earth, may have some impact. Minuscule, perhaps irrelevant. But it is my gift, the gift of stability, the gift of knowing, that all of us should want to offer. Okay, thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? Where's the love in this moment? What keeps us from feeling the stability of our own presence is that we deny our capacity to be able to hold our life, to hold our mind within our life, and to be settled with whatever the mind is doing. We let its disposition determine ours, and it never settles, and so nor do we. Do we have the capacity to first hold ourselves and whatever display or activity that is going on, to hold that as well? For we will never belong if we can't hold the mental expression of ourselves. So as we sit, That is our first priority. Okay, if there are any questions or comments, I'd be happy to. Some of you have to leave at this time, and please feel free to do so if you're ferry catching, bus catching, or whatever it is. Some of you mentioned, yes. Yes. Right, so what she's saying is that on I-5, traffic was slow and there was an accident. But instead of losing your sense in the irritation of having to slow down and stop and perhaps be late, you relaxed. And in that moment of relaxation, your thoughts were no longer self-indulgent. They then, you settle and thought, oh, wow, somebody's really hurt here. And so there's a moment of connecting with the pain of the tragedy that's up in front of you, right? It's a very nice example of something that goes on all day long. In almost every situation, somebody is not trying to be, you know, irritating. They're in some kind of problem, perhaps a mental difficulty. I was at a store the other day and the person in front of me just couldn't get the change right, you know, and I was getting irritated. So I thought, what's the matter with her? I just felt like, just give me the damn billfold off it. But then I connected with the fact that she was really having difficulty, you know, not through fault of her own. She wasn't trying to be difficult. And I thought, oh, okay, this is it. This is, okay, so okay. And then it was fine because I was in that moment. I belonged where I was, right? She wasn't keeping me from somewhere else, and that's what's essential. Is you're never being kept from somewhere else. See how quick that comes in, though. You know, you have an expectation. It just suddenly you lose the whole perspective of the moment that we're in. The moment of there has doesn't hold anything but itself, can't hold anything but itself. And we're making all these projected noise about why it's not moving in accordance to our expectation. So the expectation is the problem, not the moment. Anyone else? Okay.